Chapter 7. Mr. Hancock takes out adverts in newspapers and pastes up bills about town. On Mr. Murray's advice, he procures a tall glass dome under which they balance the mermaid upright.
"So as to look its visitors in the eye," Murray explains with relish.
They set it up on a small table in a room, just large enough for visitors to pass all the way about the creature and satisfy themselves of its authenticity before leaving the way they came in.
"There need be no more adornment than this," says Murray.
But even so, Mr. Hancock commissions a nearby draughtsman to imagine the dramatic moment in which the Japanese fishermen caught the creature in their nets. The waves rear up, and the fishermen wear triangular straw hats. In the background, there are many pagodas. The mermaid, in this image, claws its fists to its mouth and seems to be chattering in the most menacing manner, while its brothers squirm to safety. Mr. Hancock, well pleased with this rendering, pins a copy up on the wall and sends for coloured prints to sell as souvenirs. Thus, they are ready to open.
"No need for you to be here," says Murray. "'Tis all taken care of."
But Mr. Hancock wishes to observe for himself the effect his strange protégé will have on the city. And besides, Suki is wildly excited.
"You might let me accompany you," she murmurs, as she stands at his elbow for morning prayers. "Your mermaid's first social engagement," she persists as she brings in the day's loaf. "We might make a day of it,"
following him up to the turnpike as he departs to his business in the city. Even without her persistence, he would have unbent to her. He likes the sherbet stand in Seven Dials as much as she does, and he is glad to have her find his business interesting, even glamorous. He gives her leave to walk to her eldest sister's house in Wapping, and there spend 3 nights pillaging Rebbe's wardrobes for a suitable mermaid launching costume, and catching up on what mysteries whispering sisters miss when they are kept apart from one another. He therefore may blame nobody but himself when he rises on the morning of the mermaid's debut to the smell of burning cloves, and finds an unfamiliar woman leaning over the parlour mirror, blacking her eyebrows with some alacrity.
"Christ's teeth, Suki, what are you about?"
She turns with a grin on her painted mouth, and although she looks mightily pleased with herself, he cannot tell why. He had expected her to seize upon a gaudy yellow taffeta or a painted silk, something showy and indulgent, with all manner of ruching and scalloping, such as might appeal to a bright-eyed young girl. In fact, she has chosen an ensemble that unsettles him in its refinement and simplicity. A little jacket of white quilted cotton, printed with small black sprigs. Its tight sleeves have not so much as a ruffle upon them, and the body of it ends at her waist with a single flounce, and nothing more, as if it were a practical riding jacket. He cannot even complain about how much of her bosom it exposes, as she has tucked a fichu of sheer muslin about her shoulders.
"Well?"
she asks, holding out the edges of her good blue skirt, which to him looks dreadful flat without hoops beneath it.
"You need not have restrained yourself so," he says. "I would have paid for something finer."
Her lacquered eyebrows lower, and he knows he has said the wrong thing.
"This is the finest," she says. "We cut up Rebbe's bedspread for it. I know how to dress for an occasion."
She is frowning at his somewhat threadbare stuff jacket.
"Very well. I would not have the first idea, of course."
But sitting in the carriage, she still huffing, he keeps catching a glimpse out of the corner of his eye of some slim, neat, fashionable lady. And it is a shock, time and again, to turn his head and be sure it is only his little niece, wearing a smart jacket and with a vast plumed hat on her head, her eyelashes lowered and her nose tucked into a novel. He likes it less when they arrive on the corner of the Exchange. For once in London, there is no arguing. She is certainly à la mode. He fears he might lose her amongst the grown ladies who are admired as they stroll the pavements, each in their figured white gowns or their glove-tight redingotes and white stocks at their throats. On an impulse, he seizes her hand and holds it tightly.
"You're a good girl to accompany me," he says, "and you look very fine."
"Oh, you are a sentimental old man,"
she says, taking his arm, her feathers bobbing over their heads. They walk together, and she gazes about her, for the passers-by are of great interest to a visitor, comprising of ringleted Portugal Jews and Mohammedan Turks in strange draperies and turbans, not to mention the gaudy gibbering Italians and the haughty French, all there for reasons of trade or genteel asylum. She stares, too, at the passing ladies, their array of bright chintzes, their hats and their jewels and their blousy wigs.
"Do you think they're all here to see our mermaid?"
Suki whispers, tightening her grip on his arm.
"Since they are walking in the opposite direction to it, we must assume they're not."
He is steering her towards the pineapple coffee house on the corner when a hawker, an old woman with a wart on her upper lip, thrusts a rush basket of scraggled flowers, plucked from the ditches of Stepney, into his path.
"A nosegay for the lady," she croaks.
"Thank you, no,"
he bats her aside.
"Oh, now, don't she deserve it? Flowers for your sweetheart. Pretty girl like her, she deserves something for her troubles."
Suki is peering back over her shoulder at a sumptuous merchant's wife borne past in a chair painted with roses. She seems not to have heard, but Mr. Hancock is disturbed.
"What can you be thinking?" he snaps. "She is a child."
And he drags Suki onward, all his joviality evaporated.
"A change is coming,"
the woman calls after them. And he feels the muscles clench about his spine, where, if he were a dog, his hackles would have risen.
"What? I believe something unlooked for has already come to you, ain't that so? You've been surprised of late."
He strides on, not betraying his perturbation, but Suki tugs him.
"Your mermaid,"
she whispers.
"How does she know?"
"Who in this city has not received some windfall?"
he snaps.
"A change in your station. A change in your fortune."
The hag persists, and she totters after them, her flowers lolling on their stems. Her short gown is much patched. Her arms poke from its flapping sleeves, broomstick thin.
"I have the sight,"
she calls,
"and the spirits whisper news of you to me. If you would know more, it will only cost you—"
"Be gone!"
He turns to flap his hands at her. A cold perspiration has settled upon the back of his neck. He drags Suki down the next alley, and she squeals as she steps into some unnameable sludge, slithers, stumbles.
"A change in your fortune!"
she gabbles even so.
"Did you hear that, Uncle? An unlooked-for change. I think today will be auspicious indeed."
They emerge into the light, and she turns her ankle one way and then the other to inspect her ruined shoe. Muck has sprayed also up the back of her stocking.
"Ugh!"
she curls her lip, then, looking up.
"Is this it?"
"Yes."
For they are indeed arrived at the Pineapple Coffee House. There is a bill advertising his mermaid posted to one window, but otherwise it appears as it ever did, and Suki's face grows all the sourer.
"But it's so quiet,"
she says.
"There are no crowds, no lines of people."
"Is that what you expected?"
She straightens her absurd hat.
It may be better inside.
When he holds the door open for her, a few middle-aged, middle-sort men in sober felt jackets look up from their broadsheets, but they do not appear to be abuzz at the prospect of witnessing a marvel. The most animation they collectively display are those groups who gather along the benches, muttering together, "What do you make of this tip? Has the Richard passed Kent yet? And what of your own stock, Or do you mean to take our news and refuse to share your own?" But even they are barely moving their lips. This being territory that Mr. Hancock likes and feels easy in, it is little wonder that young Suki is disappointed. The air is coffee-toasted and fragrant, cosy and quiet, and nobody obliged to spend anything in order to exchange gossip and speculation in comfortable masculine quietude. Mr. Murray has sense to dabble in freaks. The money is not in coffee.
"Nobody is here," says Suki,
lowering her very black eyebrows.
"Come, that's not true. See all these gentlemen?"
Those at his favourite table, plain and honest and solid like himself, are waving and beckoning.
"Hancock,"
they call, and he joins their group, although he feels the mortification of Suki behind him.
"Hancock, what's this we hear about a mermaid?"
"I own one," he says.
"You're short of a ship, though, ain't that true?"
"No ship," he buttons his lip.
"No ship, but a mermaid."
"A courageous trade-off,"
he shrugs.
"That you may decide for yourself, for a shilling. 'Tis upstairs, ready to be viewed." "Oh, mark this, gentlemen. He's already a true showman. No concessions for his old friends. And are you to run a circus now, Hancock? The business of honest trade too plodding for you?"
He laughs along with them, but his palms are clammy and his stomach sour. On the landing outside the mermaid's chamber,
"Those men are jealous," Suki says, and he turns to her gratefully.
"Think you so?"
"Of course. Think of their disappointment when their next shipments come in and it is only miserable tapioca as usual, when Jonah Hancock was blessed with a mermaid."
She ruffles her skirts cheerfully.
"I know I'm right."
The landing is empty of people, save for Mr. Murray's boy, Daniel, who has a cash box to take payment and sits with his legs splayed before him, picking at his teeth with a little blade. He barely raises his eyes at their entrance. Equally deserted is the chamber in which the mermaid lies. Suki puts open the door and walks all about it, her footsteps loud on the floorboards.
"Well," she says, "'tis still early for the crowds. What shall we do now?"
They sit on the landing for over an hour. Nobody comes. The boy Daniel rolls up his jacket for a pillow and commences to doze. Mr. Hancock bites his nails until he tweaks a hangnail and it begins to bleed. The pain is insistent. Suki perches and reads her book, rising every now and then with a sigh to wander into the little room and look again upon the mermaid.
"Why'd you keep going in there?"
her uncle asks, blotting his bleeding thumb on his handkerchief.
"Nothing's changed."
"How do you know? You've not been looking."
At 11 on the clock, they hear scuffling downstairs and voices.
"Up. Up this way," says a female. "Careful on the stairs, my poppet."
And at last comes into view a well-dressed mamma and her attendant nurse, each clutching the fist of a small child. These children, and one is rarely no more than an infant, quite bald beneath its little cap, scramble gingerly upward, stop-start, stop-start, their breathing loud and their tongues protruding as they exert themselves to place both feet on one step before pushing off to the next one.
"Our first customers,"
whispers Suki, clasping her hands, and in smiling silence she and Mr. Hancock watch the slow and fumbling ascent of the children.
"Here for the mermaid?"
asks Murray's boy, rousing himself.
"Most assuredly."
The women jiggle the children's hands to provoke their enthusiasm.
"A mermaid, Harry? Cassie, what do you think of that?"
They turn their indulgent grins to Mr. Hancock.
"They have spoke of nothing else, you know. We are very excited, are we not, little ones?"
The children goggle in dumb confusion.
"Delightful," Mr. Hancock says. "This is very pleasing to see."
He cannot help adding, "For I am owner of this mermaid."
"You own it?"
The mamma is thrilled.
"And did you catch it yourself? Did you see it alive?"
"It died very shortly," he says. "Poor creature."
"Well, we are fascinated to see it. Shall we go in, little ones? Shall we go and take a peep at the mermaid? Yes, you would like that."
They drop their coins in the tray and lead the babes into the dimmed room, closing the door behind them. At first, there is silence. Then a querying up note from one of the ladies. Then a lusty howl. The bellowing of the children reverberates through the stud wall, and the party bursts forth in short course, the children clutched in the lady's arms, scarlet-faced and inconsolable.
"You monster!"
cries the mamma, her infant's fat tears splashing on the floorboards and snot flowing over its top lip.
"To upset innocent children in such a way!"
berates the nurse, and they descend the stairs at a far greater speed than they got up them, the children weeping all the way, and the women broadcasting their own disgust and disappointment.
"A horrid little imp! The day quite ruined!"
Mr. Hancock attempts to pursue them, calling out,
"Ladies, how can I apologize? May we not settle this?"
But they turn up their noses and affect not to hear him. On the street beyond, he can hear them resume their shrill narrative of terror to passers-by.
"Scared the babies out of their wits! A horrid thing it was, a menace and a disgrace!"
He retreats up the stairs, where Suki is standing with her palm clapped over her mouth in horror. He sits and, taking off his wig, rubs the palms of his hands over his prickled scalp.
"Oh, my girl,"
he mumbles, elbows about his face.
"We are finished before we began."
She plumps down next to him, lacing her fingers together in her lap, and they sit somberly.
"Perhaps 'tis not so bad," she ventures. "They are only two people." "But they've gone forth from here to tell the entire city. Damn Jones, his taste for frivolities will ruin us yet. And I'm no better, for I'm so credulous."
She says no more, although she is a little embarrassed at her uncle's despair under the dispassionate gaze of Mr. Murray's boy, who rattles his tray, empty but for 2 shillings, most provokingly. Chapter 8. Presently, Mr. Hancock gathers himself, catastrophe as it may be, that he has forfeited a year's profits, that his reputation has lost a great deal of its gravity. Is it not fortuitous that although he has overstepped himself in this folly, there are more terrible ways to lose what he has lost? No ships have been sunk, for one thing, not a single life lost. And if his pride is not quite what it was, he reminds himself that pride is a sin. But poor Suki, who looks now upon his shame with calm and childish eyes, has suffered most by this, although she does not yet guess it, and it is her dowry that gnaws at his spirit. He has witnessed more than once the way in which all the ardour in a young man's eyes is extinguished by a single column of figures, and a host of terrible scenes flock his head. Suki at her first dance, bashful excitement fading to shame as the beaux glance at her but do not approach, as her own peers whisper behind their fans. Suki, grown older and thinner, sitting at the parlour window still, watching for the approach of a lover who has forgotten his promises. Suki, alone in her querulous marriage bed, watching the damp spread across the wall, while her infants cry for hunger, and her husband drinks his cares away. Oh, dear Suki, what depths his folly might bring her to!
"Let this be a lesson to us," he says bravely. "I will buy us a rabbit pie for our dinner. What do you think to that?"
"Oh, we are not leaving now," says Suki. "You mean to let one single misfortune turn you back from your path?" "We have a ship to earn back," she snaps, "and a creature people will pay to view. Only a fool would not hold fast."
"Nobody wishes to view it," he says sadly.
They are interrupted by voices below.
"This way to the mermaid."
"Dear Lord,"
he closes his eyes in forbearance.
"I cannot endure this again."
He makes to rise, but Suki pulls him back.
"Where do you mean to go?"
she asks.
"Will you hide behind the curtains until they've left? Stay here with me, sir. See how it unfolds. Not long," she adds more gently, "but we must try."
A pair of young clerks comes up, scrubbed and keen. Mr. Hancock watches with dull terror as they pay their money and pass into the room where the creature awaits. But there are no screams. There is some silence. And then, as he strains his ears to hear, laughter. Betraying, could it be? Real pleasure. The men emerge at their leisure, grinning ear to ear.
"I never saw such a thing. And real, is it?"
"The genuine article," says Mr. Hancock.
"Extraordinary. I do not know what to make of it."
The pink-faced clerk is shaking his hand now.
"You're a lucky man. This is the oddest thing in the city. I'm sure of it."
"Thank you,"
he says quietly. Then, gaining confidence,
"do spread the word. Tell your friends."
"I shall speak of nothing else. To think I was first to see this."
And the men retreat incredulous and all a bubble with the spectacle. Shortly thereafter comes the stampede. Old maids and rich gents, pie-men and flower-girls and clerks and foreigners, their boots clatter up and down the stairs, and their voices fill the air in increasing excitement. They demand to see the creature that made the children cry, that made their mama faint dead away, that put a Jesuit priest into a fit, which, it is said, he is yet to come out of. In the afternoon, chairs draw up to deliver fine gentlemen and their ladies. A corpulent old woman is fairly carried up the stairs by her posse of white-clad daughters, so great is her desire to observe the creature. And in the evening, lovers come clutching hands, the girls squealing and the men preening their scientific minds. They queue out into the street until Mr. Murray distributes bone tokens amongst them and bids them avail themselves of his victuals in the downstairs room, an exercise that disgruntles the regular customers, but intrigues their visiting ladies, who have harboured dark suspicions about the places their men spend their time. The whole day passes, and still the people crush into the little room, so that they can only shuffle around the mermaid, peering and shrieking at its goblin glare. Another draftsman arrives with his pencils and sketchpad and sets about making a series of studies to be printed up post-haste. He is joined in short order by one more on the business of a scientific society who send their warmest greetings to Mr. Hancock and hope he will be agreeable to a lecture series on his extraordinary creature. Hawkers arrive, first one, then all in a swarm, to pass oranges and hot pies and small beer about the coffee house and up and down the staircase, and although the cash box fills up at remarkable speed, Suki will suffer nobody to touch it but herself, scowling at Master Daniel Murray as he heaves the takings into Mr. Hancock's own strong box. Mr. Murray scrawls tickets dated days in advance.
"Could you not have ordered more mermaids?"
he asks Mr. Hancock.
"This one is hardly enough to share around."
The end of the evening finds merchant and niece sore of foot for constant pacing and sore of cheek from constant smiling. They can hardly credit the reversal in their fortune. The morning might be 40 years distant. It has so little to do with their present situation. It is 10 o'clock, and the queue has not much abated.
"What will we do?"
asks Suki.
"Turn them away until tomorrow."
"I durst not,"
says Mr. Murray, who betrays a grain of admiration now.
"They will riot, for certain. As long as there are those as wants to see it tonight, I shall let them in."
The thought of his 20% pushes his own tiredness from his head.
"You go on home, if it pleases you. The girl is ready to drop."
Mr. Hancock turns to Suki.
"Are you?"
She is rubbing her eyes.
"A little. Only let me count up our takings."
This gives him a little pang, since she is now intimately acquainted with his financial doings. If she reports back this aberration to her mother. But then her mother will hear of this, he accepts with a chill. Perhaps she has already heard. He decides Suki is far enough stepped into this business that will do no harm for her to continue, and so he helps her carry their strongbox down to Mr. Murray's office. All day she has scribbled shillings and pence down in columns on a large leaf of paper. Now she sets about matching the coin to the figures.
"You will need a new ledger devoted to the mermaid," she says. "Daily takings and outgoings, and a separate book to account for every coin as you receive it. And you want a day book, separate again, to record particular doings and correspondence, and a file to contain all that is written about it, and finally, a large book to copy all the other books into."
"You have given this some thought," he says. He is impressed.
"Common sense."
She is stacking wobbly clipped farthings into towers and does not look up.
"No, you are an accomplished girl. One day you will be a wife of rare talent."
"Like as not."
Suki's secret ambition is to marry a gentleman in possession of a good trade but poor health, who will die very shortly after the children are born and leave her be. In such circumstances, nobody could blame her for entering into business herself, and thus thriving.
"Here,"
she says, frowning.
"I need you to count this again. I'm distracted, I dare say. My total does not seem right."
He scoops the coins towards him and begins again, while she rises and paces the room, her palms in the small of her back. Rebbe's borrowed stays pinch and do not hold her in the way she is accustomed. The coins chink against one another, and his lips move silently. At last, he sits back in his chair.
"Well?"
she asks.
"What did you come to?"
He looks a little stunned.
£38, 4 shillings and 6p.
"Then you were correct. At least by my count, this is the sum we took today."
She gives a little yelp, and he rises to embrace her.
"Dear niece, all may yet be well. What a venture!"
She nearly skips for joy.
"More than your sea captain had supposed."
"If we go on this way, we shall be..."
Shall be what? He can hardly imagine.
"No, best see it as one remarkable day."
"So, let us bow out. Well, luck favours us."
She yawns.
Ah, there is your good sense again.
We fill their minds, even when we are far away. They fancy they see us, even when they do not. They tell one another stories about us. The stories are of men who, walking on the shore, hear sweet voices far away, see a soft white back turned to them, and heedless of looming clouds and creaking winds, forget their children's hands and the click of their wife's needles, all for the sake of the half-seen face behind a tumble of gale-tossed, greenish hair. They cast themselves into the water, sometimes their shirts gone to air about their bodies, or wade ungainly across the shallows, stumbling on weed-slick rocks, the goose-flesh standing out on their calves. And sometimes they never return. Those that do, how can they explain themselves? What can they say? They felt largeness beyond words. They heard in the visitor's lovely song something so unknowably perfect, pristine as mountain ice, that they would cast everything precious aside to hear more of it. These females from the other side of the world's mirror pursue their own lust with impunity, never thinking to wait meekly to be approached, but complacent in their own beauty, calling out, "I want you. I want you. Come to me." The stories are of brave men who turn their faces away, who remain resolute on the shore, despite the ringing in their ears and the thunder of their hearts. And then what? The stories are of mermaids spurned, who burn down churches, who strike men dumb, who see to it that your cradle will remain forever empty. Petulant and cruel, these females, and vengeful. The stories are of the bravest of men who crept so softly down that the lady, communing with the wind and tides, or raising her silver arms to wring out her wet hair, never heard his approach until he seized her up. The stories are that mermaids, once subdued, make fine and modest wives, as loving mothers as any, except that they have a peculiar sense of humour, and often laugh aloud at ordinary things, like an old man hoarding his coins, or a pail of milk gone sour in a thunderstorm, as if there were something foolish to it all. And then, of course, there is no leaving a sea wife unattended. She is restive, and paces as if she still heard that dreadful calling from the water. She will go to the shore and stand there as the sea foam races about her new minted ankles, her face sheened with tears. Unwatched, she will seek out the scrap of mackerel skin that fell from her when first she was dragged from the water. Given the means to return to the sea, she will unhesitatingly cast off the bonds of motherhood, forget her uxorial vows. She will vanish forever in the turn of a wave, as if it had all meant naught to her. For mermaids are the most unnatural of creatures, and their hearts are empty of love. Chapter 9. It goes on in this way for 10 days. Mr. Hancock neglects his office to loiter in the coffee-house, marvelling at the crowds of people he has drawn there. The first arrive not long after dawn, and they continue to stream through the doors even after St. Edmund's bells chime 12. They would go all night if the door were not bolted against them. A group of Catholics come to pray about the creature and cast its demons out, but although they gibber on, the mermaid does not stir so much as a fin. Students arrive from Oxford, already drunk, and liberate it from its glass bubble for a game of catch-as-catch-can. After that, Mr. Murray arms himself with a cosh. A man from the Royal Society comes to inspect the mermaid. He does not declare himself baffled, but his face speaks it plainly.
"Ah!"
he cries in triumph after hours of increasingly frantic scrutiny.
"There are stitches on it. And here, evidence of a wire frame." "Well, how else were it to be preserved?"
asks Mr. Murray in exasperation.
"It is only mortal, after all. Its body no less corruptible than any other low creature's. We are fortunate it has been stuffed with such care as to preserve its original appearance. If it were a mere mannequin, it would require no such intervention. What greater testament could there be to its legitimacy than the fact that it has degraded, decomposed? You accepted the Kangaroo, did you not? And that was brought back a mere tanned hide."
"But that creature was witnessed alive," persists the man from the Royal Society.
"And so was this, I dare say. There's not a fishing town in England that has not been visited by merfolk at one time or another."
"Captain Cook saw the Kangaroo. A gentleman. His word is beyond question."
"Oh, a word's a word. Any gentleman can tell a lie. Any scoundrel can talk truth."
"An abundance of eyewitnesses." The gentleman's argument falters. There is real terror in his eyes.
"All of them on a same voyage," Mr. Murray muses. "Not an independent sighting amongst them."
"Well, how could there be, when no other man has ever gone there before?"
"Convenient, that. Look, sir, it strikes me as contrary that you will accept the existence of a Kangaroo, which you never saw or heard of before, on such slim testimony. And yet how many tales have you heard of mermaids, and how many sailors report seeing them? In the annals," he waves his hand to indicate the sweep of history, "there is centuries' worth of evidence to satisfactorily account for the existence of sea maidens, and yet none at all for what creatures may creep upon the plains of an entire body of land that nobody visits, and, need I really remind you, bears no name at all, but incognita."
The expert hesitates.
"Look at the thing,"
Murray exhorts him,
"and consider whether such a beast could be invented."
He pats him on the shoulder.
"You know for yourself what is true, sir."
The expert leaves, murmuring about the precision of the dorsal, the impossibility that the spine could be so fused. The skill required to create such a creature exceeds, surely, the artfulness of man. He has been caught out before, when he declared that infant lions arrive in the world as puffballs, and he is anxious of attracting any more derision to himself. Every day the takings amount to £20 or more. Mr. Hancock is gripped by a sort of exhilarated helplessness. Events sweep him onward, whether he wills it or no, and he gratefully abandons himself to Providence. He has not the requisite canniness to steer his situation, and it is with relief that he says to himself, "All this before me is uncharted." On the 11th day, he is passing through the downstairs room of the Pineapple, when a tall and lovely mulatto girl of about 17 approaches him, smiling.
"Are you the mermaid man?" she asks.
You may call me that," he says.
"You are the owner of the creature we observed upstairs?"
"That's so."
He is not much surprised by her complexion. She is by no means the strangest person to walk the exchange, but he wonders what is her provenance. She is the pride of a city trading freedman and his Kentish wife, perhaps, or a sailor's parting gift to Wapping, or the cherished bastard of a rich gentleman. By her peculiar gentility, he knows that she was not amongst the poor wretches liberated from their shackles after the American War, no longer to starve in a Virginia slave cabin, but in a glorious English garret. And if she ever was enchained herself, she does not wear that memory upon her person. Her white gown is very fine, for all its plainness. And what is this mania amongst the young for plain gowns? To his mind, a beautiful face is only enhanced by a beautiful ensemble. And where is the sense in a lady dressing as if she were a dairymaid? And she has the healthy radiance of a girl who is fed properly and rested well. Her teeth are white and all her own, her hair powdered and frizzed, her eyes warm and clever. She looks upon him without timidity, as if she never doubted her fitness to approach him.
"My name is Polly,"
she says, extending her hand with the confidence of a duchess.
"Miss Polly Campbell, I am sent to fetch you over, if you'll come."
She bobs her head in the direction of where he now sees a gouty old woman sit surrounded by young girls in white muslin, who are sipping little bowls of coffee and wincing with displeasure. They make a peculiar scene amongst the dusty and bewigged old gentlemen, who look askance at them with mingled irritation and intrigue, and clerks who leer, and young ladies with their chaperones who look and twitch their lips and look again.
"We do not wish to impose upon your time," says Miss Polly Campbell, "but my mistress has something to discuss with you."
"I have a few moments," he says, deciding that his life cannot very well become any stranger. "Good evening to you," says the old woman as they approach.
She is fastidiously turned out in green silk, which flashes with cold fire, and she wheezes with every breath, so that the fabric strains over her tight-packed bosom. She has a great powdered thatch of a wig, and no neck at all to speak of, although a large jewelled cross gleams in the crease of flesh where one might once have been. She extends a hand, encased in green knitted mittens, from which her fingers emerge strangely delicate as the paws of a little rodent, pink and plumply tapered. It is possible that she might once have been beautiful.
"Please," she says, "sit."
And he sits, mutely, watched by his dull comrades.
"Do you know who I am?"
she asks.
"No,"
he says, but while he has never seen her face before in his life, he has seen her sort, and could take a fair guess at what she is.
"Bitchapel is my name. I run an exclusive club of sorts."
The rings on her right hand clink together as she traces the walls of the tabletop.
"In St. James's."
She watches his face closely.
"King's Place."
"By the palace?"
"So near, we string our washing line upon it."
She wheezes at her own quip.
"Before my present situation, I owned a coffee house for many years. Not much like this one, I do concede. So, you see, I'm in the business of entertaining people."
The girls nod, folding their hands in their laps.
"So, Mr. Hancock, I've a proposal for you. Your mermaid, 'tis a marvel. Quite extraordinary. We were delighted, were we not, girls?"
"Oh, yes," they say. "We never saw the like. Never did."
"But,"
she holds up a hand,
"it wants displaying to its best advantage. I notice that no effort has been made in that direction."
He protests that it hardly needs displaying, that its qualities speak for themselves. But internally he agrees that he is disappointed his great discovery sits in a bare room at the top of an unadorned staircase. And if a beautiful woman wants a beautiful dress, why would not a marvellous creature want a marvellous setting?
"Look,"
she says.
"I see your strategy, if it might be called that. You display in a place like this, and you can be sure your mermaid will be seen by the greatest volume of people. And each of them pays their money, and so you become rich. Perhaps."
He waits to hear what she says next. She has such an authority about her, as is shared by his sister Hester, who has all the good sense of a man, but where Hester lacks a man's means, it is evident that Mrs. Chapel is at no such disadvantage. And so she continues.
But you do not control what sort of people, Mr. Hancock. And as far as I can make out, you have no particular plans for reaching them. You simply hope that word will spread and the public appetite for this thing will sustain itself. But how long will that last for, do you think?
Captain Jones's words return to him.
4,000 a year. I'm being conservative.
What had he expected? That this popularity would last forever? He would not expect such a thing of his tea bowls, so why this?
It is clear, he says slowly, that if I wish this thing to remain popular, I cannot leave it to its own devices.
There you have it! And I believe that the way to do this is not to court vast numbers of people, but a few people of quality. I shall be frank with you. I wish to hire your mermaid.
Ah. He knows already that he will say yes.
It is all very well to delight the masses, Mrs. Chapel continues, but why run yourself to the bone pursuing their favour? To say nothing of retaining it. A circle of much greater influence opens to you if you would enter it, for I shall bring your mermaid not to the many, but to the great.
He observes that this is not a speech that has sprung immediately into her head, but one that she has been working up for some time. So this is no whim. She has been watching and thinking since the day she first saw it.
And what would be the benefit to you?
He asks. She smiles.
In my line of work, she says, the competition is unparalleled. There must always be a novelty. And nobody else has a mermaid.
This satisfies him.
What is your proposal?
She presses her fingertips together, her rings clacketing, and touches them to her lips, as if she were thinking deeply.
A week of festivities. Soirees. Viewings, you know. Exclusive beyond your ken. All the great men will naturally come by. Royalty, probably. My parties are written up in all the magazines.
She speaks nonchalantly, but her small eyes glitter in their pouches.
On the first night, there will be a specially devised performance by my own girls, in costumes designed by me for the occasion. I have not yet lit upon the details.
And you will, what, charge entry?
She swats at the youngest of her girls, who has dared to scratch at the nape of her neck.
No, nothing of the sort. I'm not exhibiting it. Merely sharing it among friends. There'll be a strict guest list. No tickets for sale.
He is bewildered.
But I?
Of course!
She claps her little rat hands impatiently.
You're not handing it over for nothing. I shall hire it from you.
And now what? How will he know whether the sum she suggests is fair? In his daily work, he has a nose for these dealings. The value of what he is selling is deep in the marrow of his bones, for has he not grown up all his life with it? Might it not reasonably be assumed that when his mother was heavy with him, and his father climbed into the bed beside her, his talk was of chinaware and investment, favourable winds and promising deals? He never spoke of mermaids.
£200.
She says,
for a week. You may name your dates. I shall, in any case, require time to prepare.
Silence.
I have a question, he says.
Please.
She bares her teeth, yellow as old ivory.
They want a good rub with lemon juice.
Ask me.
Since it pays to be clear on these matters, he drums his fingers on the table, you are a procuress.
Yes,
she says. She does not blink. She does not turn her face away. The girls are still as they ever were.
And yours is what is called a house of ill repute. Nobody calls my house that. I have an excellent reputation.
He's thinking rapidly. He is so far from what he was a fortnight ago.
Was that your question?
She asks.
No, I have one more.
He narrows his eyes. He has heard of the equivocating ways of elves and witches. And this woman, although she is most decidedly of this world, for what other would have her, strikes him as having the same talent to tempt men into unknowing bargains.
Once your week is done, he says,
the mermaid is still mine, and you will lay no other claim to it.
That's so. £200.
Since nobody else in London is likely to supply her with a mermaid, he does not hesitate.
£300, he says.
It is difficult to tell whether her wheeze is one of surprise or the natural spasm of her troubled lungs. She presses her handkerchief to her mouth, her thin lips purpling.
£300,
she says.
Very well. That is agreeable to me.
Ah, no, he says sorrowfully. I work in guineas. Her eyes are very sharp upon his face before she begins to grin.
We understand one another, you and I. We're cut from the same cloth.
I sincerely believe we are not, he thinks. You chose this. I am only following what fate has thrown my way. But he smiles and shakes her hand warmly. Chapter 10. After taking the girls for their daily ride around the park,
it is healthful and it is instructive. If it proves also to be effective advertising, that is all to the good.
Mrs. Chapel has made it her habit to drop in on Angelica and scrutinize her for poor decisions.
No trouble,
she says as the girls lower her into her seat.
It is practically on our way home.
If practically means utterly out of your way,
sniffs Angelica resentfully up betimes. She was borne home from the Pantheon not 5 hours earlier, her feet bruised from dancing, and her voice hoarse from laughing, and now lolling in her Turkish wrap, turns her peevish attention to the tête-à-tête page of Town and Country magazine. On the table, a china pot of chocolate keeps warm over its flame, and the dresser is loaded with vases of peonies and tulips. These heavy fragrances, the one earthy, the other airy, more or less conceal the sour hint of piss that emanates from a gilt cage of snow-white mice. They sleep all in a tussle, their raspberry pip eyes closed, twitching and squeaking in their mouse dreams. It is a day of great sunshine again. The shadows of pigeons flicker across the walls, and the open window lets in the hiss of the breeze through the trees in Soho Square. Angelica, pale and creased, fills it all as an assault. The light too bright, the girls too ebullient.
How can I make a success of myself when you do not allow me my rest?
She squints over her magazine.
Oh, here is our bell. Look,
she says, shaking the creases from smudged likenesses of Mrs. Fortescue and her noble lover.
Heaven forfend, we might be allowed to forget her for one moment. I wonder, ain't it, that the press are so disgusted by this to-do, and yet continue to devote whole pages to it?
She's done well for herself,
Mrs. Chapel nods.
And so will I,
says Angelica,
not without pugnacity. The blackest and hairiest and plumpest of the dogs, who had lain meekly with his nose between his paws, springs at once to his feet and utters a yip of warning.
"There now, Fox does not like your tone," says the abbess, hauling him onto her lap and tussling his tufty face. "I meant nothing by it. In fact, I have a task for you on that score."
The girls, who sleep 8 hours a night and know better than to touch the Madeira they pour out for their visitors, are devoid of languor, rustling and nudging, whispering, "Oh, tell her, tell her, tell her." Angelica stretches. The sunlight glows rosy through her fingertips.
"What have you to tell me?"
"I have secured for us the most remarkable spectacle in London, to be displayed for 1 week only at my house. The strangest freak of nature I ever saw."
"And you bedded Chesterfield."
"You must have heard about it," says Polly. "The veriest oddity. 'Tis in all the papers."
"Oh, it must be the pig that can do sums."
"The pig may be a marvel at reading minds, but until it achieves mastery over its own bells, I cannot allow it on my Carrara again," says Mrs. Chapel. "We are all very disappointed."
"Guess again,"
trills Eleanor.
"How should I know?"
She groans and wedges her fists into her eyes, but the girls are gazing at her expectantly.
"Very well, I suppose it is some sort of creature?"
"It is,"
they rejoice, and Kitty rocks in silent joy.
"Why must you make such a noise?"
She rolls over on the chaise and wedges her face into the cold cushions.
"Why cannot you be still and leave me be?"
"But you've almost discovered it,"
says Eleanor blithely. In her life before her fall, she was a dogged smaller sister, and the habits come back to her with little prompting.
"Think of a creature. A magical creature."
"A unicorn, then?"
Angelica mumbles through satin.
"Nonsense," snaps Mrs. Chapel. "A unicorn. As if a man would travel to the other side of the world for a creature native to our own land. You're not even ashamed of your own ignorance."
"I never saw one here," says Angelica.
"Because they favour virgins, and there isn't one of those left as far as Kent."
Kitty cannot hold it in any more, although she is forbidden conversation. The exclamation pops from her like a cork.
"He's got a mermaid, miss."
Mrs. Chapel swipes her fan at her with such ferocity she might knock the nose off her face. But Kitty, a lifelong expert at dodging blows, has already darted away.
"A mermaid?"
repeats Angelica.
"Yes."
"A horrid mermaid," crows Polly. "We have seen it."
"And it's nothing like what you expect a mermaid to be."
"Well, it is only an infant."
"An ugly infant,"
Kitty adds, and claps her hand over her mouth under Mrs. Chapel's glare.
"But so were you, Kitty. And we are assured you will blossom quite beautiful."
"Sharp teeth, like a kitten's."
"And dried up. Brown. Dead."
"Dead!"
They hold their saucers sedately, but their eyes are very bright, and they talk faster than their mouths can keep up, at one moment all in unison, and the next vying against one another. The dogs catch their energy and emerge from their skirts, scampering round the chaise with their claws clattering on the floorboards.
"That is enough," says Mrs. Chapel. "It is clear you are not fit to be taken visiting. In future, I shall leave you at home for more of Madame Parmentier's lessons in walking."
The girls subside.
"It don't sound like any mermaid I ever heard of before," says Angelica.
For she was once a little child in Portsea, and there was held on a warm lap, while sailors, joyful in their homecoming, danced and sang. And this small Angelica was bright-eyed in the firelight, her thumb in her mouth and her finger hooked over her nose, as they raised their voices to tell of the fair pretty maid who lured good men into oblivion. It was the very jauntiest of all their songs, but
"Not that one,"
had said the owner of the lap, her voice abuzz against Angelica's infant cheek.
"Not on a night so rough as this. 'Tis bad luck."
"Oh, love," said the sailors, "but aren't we home now? So what is there to fear?"
"There are other boats out there yet. There will be other voyages."
The men fell silent, but in the days that followed, the children of the town took up the tune. They trooped, wind-whipped along the sea wall, clutching sticks and dolls in their cold, raw hands, and singing the forbidden song of the mermaid. The grey waves crashed below, and they raised their voices to chant.
"And three times round went our gallant ship, and she sank to the bottom of the sea, the sea, the sea."
But Angelica's recollections of her childhood are as slender as a vision, or a dream. They come to her in slivers, so prism-bright and peculiar as to make her shudder, for they seem to be from a life lived by somebody else. Still, she says, "I have always wanted to see a mermaid for myself."
"And so you shall," Mrs. Chapel pats her shoulder. "Its appearance is not what one might first expect, to be sure, but it is all the more convincing for that. We would not want science confused with art."
"How did you secure such a thing?"
asks Angelica.
"From some wretched merchant, some cit,"
Eleanor interrupts,
"who is showing it off in the most dismal manner one can imagine. He's not the first idea what he's got."
"Oh, now, now, you misspeak. He's not so bad."
I misspeak, for he ain't even a cit. He's from Deptford, not a Londoner, and greener even than our Kitty here."
"Kitty is a sly little bitch," says Polly. "This gentleman is meek as a lamb. This newly anointed gentleman, I may say, for is a veritable mushroom, sprung up overnight. He has a fortune now that he did not have this time last week, and it increases by the day."
Angelica sits up.
"And what do you mean to do with him?"
"Why, take him into hand," says Mrs. Chapel. "He is an innocent in this world."
Her pup, Fox, turns three times about in her lap, and she rubs its ear between her thumb and forefinger.
"He is lucky to have met me."
Angelica snorts.
"Poor man, it will not last. Somebody will arrive next week with a wild boy or a dog that can climb up ladders, and his little bauble will be all forgotten."
"But when the sun shines, we will make hay," says Mrs. Chapel. "I mean to hold a week of soirees and balls."
"Unlike you, you have favoured a more sober, discreet approach of late."
"Time to make a change."
Mrs. Chapel snaps her fingers at Polly, who is feeding one of the lapdogs from her plate.
"We are a venerable establishment."
Angelica is become quite jocose. She remembers Belle's observation, Mrs. Chapel is losing her touch, and determines to investigate it.
"Venerable?"
she asks boldly.
"Or démodé?"
To the girls she mouths moribund, but here she gets above herself. It is a hard word, and they only stare at her.
"Watch your mouth, madam,"
the abbess heaves in her chair.
"When you have run a celebrated institution for 30 years, you may smirk all you like. But things being as they are, that nasty expression of yours does you no favours."
Mrs. Chapel settles herself again, clasping her hands over her bosom.
"I know my business. It don't hurt to look out novelties."
Horrid